keep your wellness routine going strong all summer. Kachava's new travel packs help you stick to your daily ritual even when you're on the go. Just one packet of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake provides complete nutrition wherever you are, with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and more. Simplify your daily ritual. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.
We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. I just want to throw out a quick shout out to Austin McCoy for the show last week about De La Soul. I had so much fun doing that. This week we got back in the chair the hoops and movie savant Arya Shirazi, and oh my goodness, do we have some big things to talk about. We might not even have time for my full agenda, but I'm so excited to get cracking and see if we can do it. Arya, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
I'm doing great because we got three pieces of news I'm very happy to talk about. Number one, your Washington Wizards. I should say my Washington Wizards, given that I've adopted them long ago as my team through a lot of ups and downs. Well, let's be honest, downs. Just got the number one pick in what is being considered the most stocked NBA draft since the 2003 draft that was led up by LeBron James at one. Let's not forget number two, Darko Milicic, and then number three, of course, Carmelo Anthony, and then you had Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. This is being considered a draft in that class, and the Wiz have the number one pick, a team that has not had a 50-win season in over 50 years with the number one pick. Number two, what we got to talk about is, we got to talk about it, man, Philadelphia, the 76ers going down in a sweep to the New York Knicks. Philly, of course, your team, if they, you did caveat it with staying healthy, them going all the way to the finals, we should talk about that. I think that's a fascinating topic, frankly, about everything that happened in this series, especially because a lot of people actually were picking Philly before this series, not only you, sir. And then number three, if we have time, and I hope we do, we want to do this thing where you name a movie that I like that you just do not care for. I name a movie that I know you like and you don't even know what I'm choosing, that frankly I do not care for particularly. And then we're going to get each other's gut response. I'm excited about that. I hope we get to it, and I think we will. But first and foremost, Shiraz, your response upon hearing that the Washington Wizards, the Wizards, after a humiliating regular season that included seeing Bam Adebayo score 83 points on them in a game, a lifetime, I think, 16-point-a-game score. The Washington Wizards getting the number one overall pick. What are your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, I didn't just hear about it. I watched it. I love Lottery Day, and I made a point of watching it smack in the middle of Mother's Day. So there go my middle-aged priorities. As you said, this has been long talked about as an incredibly stacked draft, particularly the top four and then depth beyond that. I would be incredibly impressed if any of the players in this draft reach or eclipse this past year's top four.
Yeah.
I thought this past year's rookie class was kind of incredible. So if this rookie class incoming is considered even more more potentially league altering, then yeah, the teams that won the lottery really had a good day. And obviously Washington As you said, far more downs than ups, historically and definitely recently. Yeah, they cashed in, and both they and the Jazz, who got the second pick, made franchise-enhancing moves this past year with an eye towards those moves taking effect this year. So, in addition to adding the number one pick, I'm not familiar with really any of these top players' games, but I know the names, and I know that Dabanca from BYU is kind of viewed, if there is a consensus, he's kind of right now, I think, the favorite to be number one, and he's kind of a uber athletic, multi-tool forward scorer, I believe. So if that is who Washington adds to Anthony Davis and Trae Young, they should be thinking playoffs. Just
Absolutely.
like if Utah got number two, so they will presumably get a franchise type player, which is how these top picks are being described. And they also kind of committed to moving past a very putrid and depressing recent franchise history when they brought Jaren Jackson Jr. on to team with Markkanen in a really multi-dimensional and very tall front court. So yeah, Washington and Utah obviously were the big winners, and Memphis and Chicago jumping spots, rounding out that top four. Both of those teams, their rosters are kind of spare. So I think that they really helped themselves and possibly accelerated an inevitable rebuild by landing these picks. Before I turn it back to you, I'd say the big loser is the Nets.
Oh, I
Brooklyn,
disagree. I think they're the second to biggest loser, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Brooklyn had, oh, maybe Indiana's the biggest
Yes,
loser. Of
Indiana's the
course,
biggest
they
loser.
had a terrible season
To
and they lost their lottery pick. Yeah, so,
Clippers!
but the Nets have, I think, the bleakest roster in the league. They have maybe three or four legitimate NBA rotation players on the entire team. Their five first round picks from last year, notwithstanding. And those guys didn't look particularly impressive to me when I saw them, which was never. So Brooklyn was definitely hoping, if not to land in the top two, definitely to get one of those coveted top fours. By virtue of the Grizz and Bulls leapfrogging, they're finishing sixth, which means they should probably get a starter, is what I'm hearing,
A
and
very,
somebody who
maybe a
should be
very, very
maybe
good one.
been a franchise cornerstone for a while. That's how deep this draft is being described. But Brooklyn definitely did not want to finish sixth.
Great roundup for you, sir. Let me give our listeners a sense, because I've been following this as a Wizards fan like a hawk in terms of these players. A quick overview on the top four that Arya's talking about. Each one a franchise-altering player, each one with a flaw that potentially you could see like, oh, like 10, like 5 years from now, we could be like, oh, that guy didn't quite make it. So that makes it kind of intriguing. Like, to me, Cooper Flagg, like last year, for an example, like his floor was still very high. Some of these guys, the ceiling is through the roof, but the floor makes you a little bit nervous. So let me go through them a little quick. The consensus number one, as you said, AJ DeBanza. I'm going to go back to his flaw in a second, but this dude is a monster. Like, you watch him on the court, it has the feel of, even as a freshman at BYU, like the idea of the man playing with boys. Bigger, stronger, faster, huge stride going to the hoop, a born scorer, and super intense. That's what you love about him. Like, he wants to be the number one pick. He wants to be a franchise guy. He wants to be a wrecker of worlds. I think he walks into the NBA as a 20-point a game scorer if he's on a team that needs him to do that. Love DeBanza. Number two, I'll say his flaw in a second. to Darren Peterson, Kansas, the best high school player in the country, considered by far. Somewhat of a disappointing season at Kansas, but people still love him to death because of his high school tape. Three, the son of Carlos Boozer, coming to the fore. It was a Cam Boozer. And Cameron Boozer, he has is considered to be the highest floor of any of these players. Like, his game is really solid. A walking 20-point a game guy, super incredible with the fundamentals. Not the highest ceiling at all, but somebody who's going to walk in and start for a team at age 19. And number four, this is the guy who's got a lot of people with their tongues wagging. This guy, Caleb Wilson from North Carolina, who's like if Sean Kemp and Tracy McGrady had a baby, but also at the same time, yikes, if Sean Kemp and Tracy McGrady had a baby, like think of older Sean Kemp. It makes you a little bit nervous. Now, to go through the, although, you and I both are, suckers for Prime Kemp, but to now a weed impresario with his Rain Man weed stores in the Seattle area. So doing very well, Sean Kemp, which I don't think anybody predicted. But to go through the top four real quick, the thing about DeBansa, which makes you a little bit nervous, is he just did not look thrilled to be for the Wizards got number one, because this is so rare, Shiraz, but DeBansa, and I don't think I've ever used this phrase since Stockton and Malone, he's a Utah guy. Like, DeBansa loves Utah. He was a Massachusetts kid who was given a ton of money in high school to play in Utah, to go to BYU, and then with the hope that he would be on the Jazz. So when he saw that the Jazz were in the top two, the word is that he was pumped to go to the Jazz. And then anybody who saw his face when the Wizards got that number one pick, he didn't look thrilled. So it's kind of like the reverse of last year. If you remember, Ace Bailey out of Rutgers was trying to manipulate the draft through his agent to go to the Wiz, and then was really disappointed to go to the Jazz. So kind of like a reverse version of that, except DeBance is a much better player than Bailey. The thing about Peterson, already mentioned it, just there's concern about, like, how much does this guy really love the game? Like, he played it very soft at Kansas this year. He didn't play a lot of second halves even. He dealt with cramping issues, he said, during the season. It's just all kinds of stuff that make you wonder about his motor, because his game reminds you of Kobe Bryant. But does he have the Mamba mentality? I hate that so much, but still, that question of want to is very real. Boozer, the issue is his ceiling. Like, is it really that much higher than his floor? Great fundamentals, but not nearly the out of his world, holy crap athlete that is Caleb Wilson. And Caleb Wilson is the one I would probably describe as the greatest variance between floor and ceiling. Like, he could very well be a bust. He also can jump out of a gym and is just a wildly talented player. After that, you got lots of fun guys. This kid, Acuff, might be Kyrie Irving coming out of, might be the number one pick in other drafts. Coming out of Arkansas, you got this kid Flemings who's coming out, who's crazy. I mean, it's going to be a really, really fun draft because a lot of teams are going to see franchise alterers. But we're talking about the Wizards. So the thing that I'll leave you with after my little description here is we might actually see a situation, maybe, where the Wiz turn to Danny Ainge and the Jazz and say, "Hey, you've been coveting this DeBansa kid for." I'm kidding, not kidding around. Like, he's a 19-year-old who they've been scouting for 5 years. And so which is bizarre, actually. Like, the Jazz actually were part of paying the NIL money to get him into Utah and through BYU. And so,
That sounds perfectly legal.
so ethical. So then the question then comes in, like, do the Wiz actually decide, we could take DeBansa and have this franchise-altering player who everybody's really excited about? And that's what I hope happens. Certainly, as just somebody who likes watching the game, because that's the guy I want to see. But you could also maybe see them, taking out the old, the Benelli rifle and putting it to Danny Ainge and being like, how many first-round picks plus your number two pick plus Ace Bailey who wants to be here? are you willing to give us for us to flip to number two? And then Peterson actually fits really well into the Wiz lineup in terms of what they do not have. I know they don't have a lot, but if you assume that Davis will play, although he's given some indication to the contrary because he's not my kind of guy. In terms of like, oh, I won't play for the Wiz. Like, oh, you're too good to play for the Wizards. Give me a break. Why don't you play 50 games in a season before you start talking that yin yang? Sorry, I'm a little angry about Davis, but that's my thinking on this. Like, hey, if they hold up the Jazz and get a haul, I would very much enjoy seeing if Darren Peterson can fulfill his high school potential when everybody said he was going to be the number one pick over DeBanza after 1 year. But I would also love to see DeBanza because he is entertaining as hell to watch. So that's where I'm standing on this draft right now. An incredible day for your Washington Wizards. And did you, first of all, I thought you might have enjoyed the lottery more than the average bear because, I love when they decide like who sits to represent the teams. And you got the Silver Fox, Toni Kukoč, your guy sitting in for the Bulls. I'm sure that gave you a thrill. And for me, I
Welcome
got a
to Good
similar
Luck.
thrill. I got a similar thrill seeing our my home, my son and I, we watched the draft together, our favorite player during his childhood, John Wall, representing the Wiz in their seats. So a fun lottery all around.
Wall
John
not looking
Wall.
in playing shape these days.
Yeah, that might have been said by Jacob and me, but
Pretty close.
we're gonna walk away from Kukoč looked in better playing shape. But throwing it to you, Shiraz, that's my general take on the top four. And the Wizards, they hold all the cards, man. It's very exciting.
My only last comment on that before we move on is speaking to your hypothetical scenario. If I were Utah, there's no way I would entertain that because this is being talked about as a top four that's almost wow. Any of these guys could wind up being the best player. DeBanza is not the Wembanyama of it.
No.
So for Utah, I know he's a Utah guy who's the rare player who wants to be in Salt Lake City, and that definitely has value. But to think about trading your number two, who might very well wind up being better than number one, from what I'm hearing, whoever winds up slotting where, plus any future first, plus Ace Bailey, who was your recent lottery pick, in the chance that DeBance is going to be so much better. If I was Utah, I would not do a deal like that. I would be very content choosing number two and seeing where the cards fall. But listen, as a Wizards fan, you've definitely earned the right to dream unrealistically.
Unrealistically. I mean, I agree with you that there's no Wembanyama, but I feel like my dreams are realistic, buddy. An
I just mean
all-time
as far as
draft.
extorting other teams.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I don't know, man. I mean, imagine for a second, we don't know because we're in this northeastern corridor of awesome ball, but imagine being in the wasteland of Utah and having somebody who at least potentially is a generational player. Who's like, I love Utah. It just doesn't happen. So I could see,
Yeah,
I don't
all
know,
right.
I could see Ainge getting a little bit desperate and throwing the Brinks truck at the Wiz. I mean, I could be wrong. What do I know? And frankly, like I said, I don't really care because I want them to take DeBanza. So, but it's an interesting angle, it's an interesting wrinkle. The other wrinkle that you mentioned, and then we can move on, just because I find it so goddamn interesting, is Indiana. They have this gap year basically without Haliburton. They're setting themselves up for a high pick in, like we keep saying, in this loaded draft. And they make this decision to trade for a good, not great center in Ivica Zubats with the hope and frankly the odds that they'll also have a top four pick on top of that, basically trading Benedict Mathurin for a for Ivica Zubats, but they land out of the top four, and now the Clipper, they basically traded Zubats for Mathurin in the fifth pick. which is just a wildly terrible result for the Pacers. So, given my feelings about the Pacers, I couldn't be happier. Just had to throw that in there.
Well, I'm not trying to stir up any acrimony here, because I like you. But
Thank you.
a year ago at this time, you were crowing about Zubats as being one of the top four centers in the entire league and a defensive player of the year candidate. And boy, do you love Zubats. And
Yeah,
now
I've
you're like,
shifted
oh,
on
and
that.
this average center who. So anyway,
I
I
said
just had
good,
to
not great. I
didn't let
said
you
good,
quite
not
get
great.
away with that. No, I mean, and Indiana must have thought as high on him as you did a year ago, because they knew the trade they were making. They knew they
Risk.
were having a terrible season, and they made it just top four protected. So they knew there was a fair chance they wouldn't get it. To me, it is disappointing, but not catastrophic. Indiana's gap year was kind of primarily brought on by them knowing Tyrese Haliburton was going to be out for the season and then letting Miles Turner leave in free agency, which now does not look like a terrible decision on their part. And so I think they made them, obviously they wanted to keep their lottery pick, but looking at Zubats and Haliburton and a healthy Zubats and Haliburton, which neither of them really were last year, adding to a still all-star caliber Siakam and the rest of their team. Oh, it would be a huge cherry if they had a top five pick, or they're picking at the top of the draft. But again, I don't look at this as a complete catastrophe because I expect Indiana to be back to be above 500 again next year. So I think they made the dis it didn't look like Mathurin was going to be part of their future,
Yeah.
actually.
Yeah, agreed.
So I think that they were looking more at let's lock down that center position with certainly a top 10 center in the league with who we have returning as a better investment to return to contention immediately than adding Haliburton and crossing their fingers on a huge upside 19-year-old.
Yeah, okay, I'll go with that. That doesn't change the fact that I think they feel like they were kicked in the ding ding this morning, because to be one pick away from getting one of these blue chippers and to have it go to the Clippers. One thing it does, I have to say, is all the people who love being on these podcasts that I listen to, and they always speak of the draft in terms of conspiracy. Like Flagg being the number one pick last year as a makeup for Luka going to Dallas, things like that, conspiracy. Given how the Clippers have been mired in scandal all season, with the owner Steve Ballmer paying Kawhi Leonard under the table, circumventing the cap allegedly, they've been subject to a year-long investigation. I mean, for the Clippers to come out smelling like roses, really is a mark against this idea that there's some grand conspiracy, because they would have wanted, I think, to punish the Clippers. And
They're not
instead,
fixing it every year, Dave.
only sometimes. Or maybe they fixed it for the Wizards.
Sometimes when it really, I mean, fixing it every year would be very sloppy.
That's a good
This
point.
is a public event. I believe Price Waterhouse is involved.
Yes.
So,
The
no,
firm
I
of
mean it is.
Ernst and Young.
It is selective corruption.
Yes.
Patrick Ewing going to the Knicks. Anthony Davis going to New Orleans when the NBA has assumed ownership and is trying to drive up the value of that franchise as much as possible to sell it will ensure that this year they get the number one pick. Cooper Flagg to Dallas. But most years, I don't think that, that then they chill for a while. I think this
Amazing.
year was probably on the up and up.
I hear you. I hear you. On the up and up indeed. Unless the love of the unless, maybe this is just more about karma, but Utah has been the most egregious tankers in the league for years. So to put them so close to the DeBansa apple.
I wasn't happy with them getting two. I wanted them to fall back.
Me too.
I didn't.
Me too.
I've hated the way Utah has conducted their on and off court business for the last 5 years.
More than
So,
any other team, I think, have they been the most
absolutely,
egregious?
absolutely shameless. So, I would have loved them to have fallen back as far as they could go.
Amen.
But they didn't. So, no
And
justice.
no justice and certainly no peace. Speaking of no peace, no peace for the Philadelphia fans losing 4 games to nothing, 76ers, Knicks. One commentator, I'm just going to quote them, like, that last game, that game four, Philly going down 144-114 to the Knicks. They said it made it feel like the Knicks swept by winning 5 games instead of four, given that level of dominance towards in the first and last game, certainly. Your thoughts about the 76ers, who really became kind of a fan's pick to beat the Knicks. Like, wow, this team is finally has it together. We love Maxey, we love Edgecombe. People want Embiid, given the guts of him coming back after the appendicitis so quickly. Like, let's see them make a run. And then the Knicks not only thwarted those dreams, I mean, the Knicks throttled them in 4 straight games, which I don't think anybody saw coming at all. The 4-game to none throttle. Your thoughts about the series that you just witnessed, especially given your affection for this 76ers team?
And I'm gonna try to keep my remarks fairly brief because I really do want to talk movies with you. But I had the 76. I'm a Sixers fan and I'm a Knicks fan. Those are my two favorite teams. I may be the only one. I don't know anybody else like that. So I'm very conflicted when these teams meet each other in the postseason. I want them both to win. And only one team won this time, and it wasn't close. I had picked the Sixers over the Celtics. I was in the minority. It looked like they were going to go down in five, and it was triumphant. Not only that unlikely series comeback, but who they beat. So, as you said, going into the series against the Knicks, I had it at almost 50-50 in a way. And that's not how it turned out. And clearly Maxey, he suffered a finger injury on his shooting hand late in the season. And he could not shoot in this series. He could not shoot from long range, which definitely negatively affected the diversity of his offensive game, which is really the engine of bringing out everybody else on the Sixers' offensive game and allowing them to flourish. So that was a factor. That being said, this was not a matter of one injury. The Knicks, I was not happy that they drew the Hawks in the first round. And they went down 2-1, and that was not surprising. I don't think that was super surprising. I think if they had lost to the Hawks, it would have been very disappointing, but not earth-shattering because it didn't seem like a great matchup. And Atlanta was one of the very best teams in the whole NBA, certainly in the East, second half of the year. After going down 2-1, the Knicks have been the best team in the NBA since. They have kicked the shit out of every opponent they have played since. One game was close in the Garden in game two, where Philly, a couple of bounces here and there looked like they even the series. And hey, if they go back to Philly 1-1, who knows? But who cares?
Right.
Because they went to Philly and the Knicks, I think, outscored them by like 45 points over 2 games. So, and any contin asterisk, which there really is none, about Maxey's injury, the Sixers were trotting out their full squad, which is a rarity, whereas Anunoby, undeniably the Knicks' third best player, missed games 3 and 4. So, if anything, the Sixers had the more complete team. And the game that they were competitive in was the game that Embiid didn't play. So every possible advantage, every way that I and probably many other people looked at it going in did not play out. I picked the Sixers to beat the Celtics. I thought they'd be very competitive against the Knicks. At the beginning of the season and the beginning of the playoffs, I picked a Knicks-Lakers finals. Looks like one of those might still happen. But the Knicks are looking great, and I think should feel confident about whoever comes out of Detroit and Cleveland, which I think is going to be the Cavs.
Wow, that's interesting. If you're the Knicks, let's just to spin it for, I think you covered Philly well. I have nothing to add to that. If you were the Knicks, and I definitely agree with no asterisks because the Knicks have been just the level that the Knicks have been playing at has been so above and beyond the competition, and not just the competition of who they're playing, but relative to even teams like Oklahoma City. Like, it's just been a marvel to watch. And for all the crap that Mike Brown, the coach of the Knicks, has gotten this year, the very interesting, somewhat at the time curious decision to, like, because everybody was saying Karl-Anthony Towns isn't touching the ball on offense. Karl-Anthony Towns isn't touching the ball on offense. So Mike Brown's like, not only is he going to touch the ball on offense, we are actually going to run the offense through Karl-Anthony Towns. So this player who's played a lot of playoff games, let's remember with the T-Wolves, who never had more than five assists in a playoff game, and he only did that once, is averaging eight assists a game in these playoffs with several double-digit assist games. And he hasn't even played in the Philly series, at least he didn't play 30 minutes in one game. I mean, and so that decision by Mike Brown is just looking absurdly smart. It also saves Brunson for the fourth quarter, where it just seems like he's just, not that he's not always great in the fourth, but to see him with a little bit of oomph and step in that period, man. I mean, I'm just so impressed with these Knicks. They were my pick before the season began to make the finals. I predicted them playing the Houston Rockets, so grain of salt on my predictive abilities on that front. And I picked the Rockets by a hair over the Denver Nuggets. So, yikes, two first round outs for me. I did like the Spurs, but that's a whole separate conversation. I didn't see the Spurs as a finals contender, but just as a better team than most people were saying. But to go to spinning it forward, if you're the Knicks, who would you rather play? Because Cleveland is easily the more talented team compared to Detroit. But Detroit just crushed the Knicks during the regular season. So who would you rather play if you're a Knicks?
Backing up just for a second on the Bockers, and this is not going to sound surprising coming from me, but first of all, the Knicks are clicking on every cylinder. It's their defense which most impresses me. The thing that was most noticeable to me from the start and throughout the entire series against Philly is the amount of open shots that the Knicks got compared to the Sixers. The Sixers have playmakers, and they were harassed at all times. None of those guys. When Paul George was making shots, which he was at times in bulk, and then he'd have long droughts, fatal droughts. But when Paul George was making shots, he was making impossible Paul George style shots. Shots that no one else would take and that he makes. But Philly was laboring with excellent offensive players. It was challenging for them to get into an offense. The Knicks' defense, the Knicks' rebounding, the Knicks' hustle is is overwhelming their opponents or has been in the last bunch of playoff games. Offensively, and again, they put up 140 something. They've been doing that. It is because the ball's in Towns' hands. That is why that is happening. Towns, to me, is playing like Jokic. The Knicks are getting open shots. They have never gotten more backdoor dunks than they do now. They get two or three a quarter. The open threes. Yeah, Deuce McBride and Landry Shamet are going to hit open threes, and that is what they are getting. Jalen Brunson's a great scorer. He's not a playmaker. He dribbles with his head down. That's what makes his shot making impressive. He's looking at his feet, and he drains a shot in the face of somebody who's 6'5". But Jalen Brunson is not a playmaker. Jalen Brunson does not, when he draws defenders, multiple defenders, he's not always hitting the open person. Putting the ball in Towns' hands, the half court is totally open. What I'm loving about the Knicks offense, Carl came to New York 2 years ago, and one of the first things people said about him is maybe the best 3-point shooting center ever. And I don't know if I've ever really agreed with that. There have been a lot of great 3-point shooting centers, but that was a huge part of his game. And the fact that he's a five-tool scorer, but it was really the fact that he was that 3-point. He doesn't shoot threes. He doesn't look to shoot. He drives to the basket and mostly patiently sees who's open, hits them, and the Knicks score. And then play tight ass defense on the next possession. So I'm saying that I think that that is directly attributable to why the Knicks offense is clicking on the level of its defense right now at the best possible time that all those things could be clicking. Don't know who I want and don't care. I'd never put that much stock in what a team does against in the regular season. I think you can figure it out. There's tape of those four games. Watch it. Knicks have better players than Detroit and are playing really, really great. Detroit showed they're a serious team by coming back against Orlando when it looked like they were out. And they've looked good against Cleveland so far. James Harden had to be out of character to come through in the fourth of a playoff game to make sure that Detroit didn't go up 3-0. So the Pistons are playing well. It doesn't matter. I mean, I would actually rather play Detroit. As a Knicks fan, I'd rather play Detroit because I think that Cleveland's a harder team to beat than the Pistons are. If the Knicks don't win, I like the Cavs more, so I'd rather the Cavs go to the finals than the Pistons. But honestly, it doesn't matter to me. I hope this current series goes seven because I like seven and I actually like watching like these two teams play against each other. But I don't have a clear cut. I think I'd rather play Detroit. I'm more afraid of Cleveland.
In my opinion, that is the correct answer. As if I'm the sage, but or the savant,
You
but
are.
I would much rather the Knicks go in and be like, okay, Detroit, you might have lambasted us in the regular season, but it's revenge time. I feel like the Knicks have that mentality right now, where they would go in with that kind of an edge. And Cleveland's talent, like who guards if Donovan's on a heater. Who guards Donovan Mitchell on the Knicks? These are big questions, because then if you slide over Josh Hart, you leave another hole like in the front. So it's like they do create matchup problems. Of course, you don't have to guard James Harden, but you never know. I always expect him to snap into shape and have some series like where he scores 30 a game or something. And it's never happened before, but you always want it to happen because he's that good. Even though I'm not a fan of him as a player, I've never been a fan of seeing, like, to use baseball terms, the Chuck Knoblauch, the Rick Ankiel, the Steve Blass. Like, I don't like it when players their minds go and they all of a sudden just don't look like themselves. It kind of makes me blue. So I'd like to see him do his thing. All
I
right.
don't know that I would put James quite in that
Yes.
territory.
It's close
Going to
though in
finish his
playoff
career as
time.
a top 10 all-time scorer and has probably, I think with Houston, he had series where he averaged 30 and they won. He just hasn't done it when they've progressed in the playoffs. But I actually think that he's not, and I don't look at any stats or anything, so I'm just talking from hazy memory. But I don't think, I think Harden has had some high profile major letdowns, which tend to carry the narrative. But I actually don't think he's been as terrible a postseason performer as people think that he has. He
Fair,
just
fair, fair,
hasn't
fair.
been the guy to take them to where they want to go. And maybe he's just not that guy.
Well, I'll say that's fair. All right, let's throw it, if we could, to a movie talk that we've been wanting to have for some time, in the time we have left. What we wanted to do for this is to name a movie that not only, I didn't describe it perfectly at the start, like not only that the other person likes, but one that's generally regarded as a classic that the other person just did not like, with the assumption that, it's going to cause a ruffle a feather or two with the other person. So I say that as a preamble because, like, for example, it would be very easy to name an Oscar winner that now people are very kind of about, like a Forrest Gump or an English Patient, that certainly have their haters. It's
Birth of
much
a Nation.
tougher. What's that?
Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, like it's to take the controversial view that Gone with the Wind has not stood the test of time. No, but to name some films that actually do have some gravitas that we just do not care for. Shiraz, do you want to go first with your film that you are just not a fan of that?
Yes,
I know the
and
film, so
I.
I can tell you I do like this film very much. So please,
Yes,
break
you
away.
know what it is. Looking forward to having this discussion. And the movie that I am choosing is The Blues Brothers. And
Hurts.
coming to terms with the fact that actually I didn't think The Blues Brothers were cool, and I didn't think that it was a good movie. Was a growth moment for me because we grew up in a time where the Blues Brothers were very present and they were very cool. I'm too young to remember them in their origins on Saturday Night Live, but because of that, and then because of the subsequent film, the Blues Brothers were very, very much in the public consciousness in my young life, and were something that I was introduced to only as good and as very cool and as very funny. The first I'm certain that the first time I heard the song Soul Man was the
Definitely.
Blues Brothers version. That's how I learned that song, and I liked it. And then later I heard the original, and I was like, oh, this is a better song, and it makes a lot more sense. But again, I mean, being familiar with those characters and seeing the movie several times as a young person, and knowing again who the actors were, the performers were behind those characters, just kind of added to this sense that, you didn't question that the Blues Brothers, were something, were just something that, of course, we liked. And of course, we were down with, and of course, that we were on the side of. And as I said, as we get older, we want to show growth. We want to show self growth. And this was a tangible area where I felt as though being able to admit to myself and others that I just do not like the Blues Brothers was somewhat liberating. And before I turn it over to you, who remains a fan, Blues Brothers was, I think, the first of the Saturday Night Live sketches to be made into a full-length film. And its descendants have kind of a dubious history in general, I think, with a couple of box office exceptions. And it makes sense to me because it is turning a 7-minute sketch into a full-length film. And while the Coneheads might be very, very amusing for 7 minutes, trying to squeeze 90 minutes out of that concept, I think is a lot harder, and is ultimately a futile exercise. And the Blues Brothers, in a way, somewhat follows that pattern. To me, there's really not very much to it. And to me, it almost never really advances past the concept that John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd look kind of cool in black suits and shades. And it is a film filled with musical royalty. And real briefly, Belushi is sprung is it gets out of prison at the very beginning and meets up with his adoptive brother, and they learn that the orphanage that they grew up in is about to go bankrupt. So they're gonna put the band back together for a benefit concert and save the orphanage. Kind of like a time-tested narrative trope. And again, I mean, they're aided by, and in a way, it feels as though this story is created to allow luminaries such as Aretha Franklin and James Brown and Ray Charles to have a scene where they do a musical number. And it kind of hops from one musical number to another. And then just kind of kills a bunch of time. And I think the last few times I've seen the Blues Brothers, which really cemented its standing in my mind and in my heart, I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's funny at all. I don't think those characters are funny, and I don't think anything that happens is funny. It's very, very mean-spirited. And some mean-spirited can be very funny. I'm not against mean-spirited. Some of my favorite things have are mean-spirited. My favorite funny things.
The
This
Whoopi
is
Boys.
not a mean-spiritedness that makes me laugh. It's also interesting because I had talked about how thin I find the plot on paper. Actually, I think it reads better than it actually plays out because describing the plot a little further, through their various hijinks of trying to put this benefit show together in Chicago, they run afoul of and then are trying to escape and avoid the police, neo-Nazis, and a country western band, among others. And those are all people that you want to avoid, that you should be fleeing from. So again, on paper, this looks like certain plot points or philosophies that I would be down with. But to me, nothing, very little rewarding plays out of that. Really, most scenes are reduced to, and I think that this is where a lot of people really like it. car chases and an incredible amount of destruction of property, primarily vehicles. I've never been into car chases. They, after 45 seconds, they really bore me. I don't usually get invested in the magic or the choreography or the photography or the special effects aspect of car chases and explosions. Which in many films are kind of the central conceit, are very big sellers, just not really my bag. And the Blues Brothers, every other scene is a car chase where a lot of shit gets damaged, resulting in I think one of the most famous scenes of destruction on celluloid, where a record number of police cars get damaged as a result of the Blues Brothers trying to save like their one shitty orphanage, and that's all swell. And before I turn it over to you to tell me where I've gone wrong, is this all plays out not over the course of a more merciful and manageable 90 minutes. This is something I actually checked. This film is 130 minutes. This
It's a
is a
long time.
long movie. It takes a long time to get to nowhere. And looking back now, not, you know, now this is an old film. In addition to Belushi and Aykroyd, and again, I believe Belushi died 2 years later. So the whole aura around John Belushi, who again was a very, very an unquestioned important figure in my young life and most likely yours as well. I love Belushi. I just don't love him in this. I don't love anyone in this. And as I said, it's got a very now intriguing, eclectic cast coming out of 1980. In addition to the two leads and those legendary musicians, Carrie Fisher and John Candy turn up, among some other recognizable names. But to me, it is not nearly as fun, again, as it looks like it would be on paper, and how my young memory always processed it. It confirms that I am not a fan of the Blues Brothers, and I'm comfortable saying that. How do you feel about this film?
Well, you make some incredible points, and let me first of all, I in se in seven syllables, I can say why you're wrong. Heidi, 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 hi. Talking about
Yeah, I'm wrong.
the Cab
Cab
Calloway
Calloway.
scene at the end. Calloway makes the film. All right, here's where I agree with you. You make great points. I also not a fan of the car chases. That's just death for me, especially one that basically was everybody just on cocaine offset, just saying let's crash as many cars as possible. I just don't find it very interesting. The same way there are parts of the movie where if you're sober and you hang out with somebody who's very high, especially if they're jacked up on after taking a bump or two, it's not a good time. And so there's that aspect of it where it's not a good time. There's aspects of it where it's an amazing time. And I like it because of the scenes with the set pieces with the stars, less so the Aykroyd Belushi dynamic, although it is very funny when they're in the fancy restaurant and Belushi's like, "How much for the girl? How much for the girl?" I found that to be funny. And also, I think the scene with Aretha Franklin is just a classic where she sings Think. Just an incredible scene. The Cab Calloway I mentioned, James Brown is the preacher. Let's not forget John Lee Hooker showing up to play a song, the great blues maven. So there's enough there for me that I find it really entertaining. And to see someone like John Candy, who wasn't really known on the scene yet, when you go back and watch it, that's a lot of fun. And I think it's a it's too long. You're right about that too. I think it's what I would call a rewatch, in that if I'm like flipping channels and the Aretha scene is about to start, I'm staying on the TV. If Cab Calloway's on, I'm gonna stay on the TV. If the car chase is on, I'm turning the channel. There are certain scenes in there that I find to be classics, and I'm a sucker for nostalgia. So it is a film that's very much of its time and place, and it transports me. I do think that if I say tried showing it to my son, he would look at me and say, "Why are we watching this?" So that's another check in your benefit. So some of it is also about, the memory of watching it when I was really young, how anarchic it seemed, and how much I loved Belushi, who I'm sure had died by the time I'd seen it, but was already kind of a legend ensconced in my brain just from seeing the clips of him from Saturday Night Live and the like. And it only grows with legend because of Belushi. There was just a documentary about Belushi that got a lot of pub. It's widely known that the film Ghostbusters was written for him and not Bill Murray, which is an interesting what if. If Belushi could have pulled that off. I don't really see him as Venkman. I think Murray owns that role, but that's another conversation. So if you ask me, like, how much do I like the Blues Brothers, I would say, you're not talking about one of my faves, but to me, it's a legit 3 stars out of 4, and I like the set pieces so much. And if you have me with a fast forward button, I'm having a good time. That's my general response.
Yeah. Movies I like, I don't want a fast forward button.
Fair
If I
enough.
like a movie, I want to see it all.
Fair enough.
And I absolutely appreciated your response. A few good scenes a long movie doesn't make, to me. You've mentioned, yeah, a couple of scenes, sure. And the music scenes, are the most spirited. But as I said, this is thought of as a classic comedy, it's called a classic comedy, and you nailed it perfectly. I think that it is it does not go beyond the nostalgia effect and the nostalgia trip for those who were there to feel nostalgic about it. And the last I'll say on it is that I used to not question that Dan Aykroyd constantly repeating, "We're on a message from Gad," was funny, but it's not. I just heard myself say it, and I don't want to laugh.
I
And
chuckled.
to me, I mean, what else? Like, is that kind of the only thing his character does? Behind crash a whole lot of cars and put a lot of civilians in danger?
He could bring more to the table. You're not wrong about that. A lot
Let's
more.
talk your movie. I do not know what it is, so I'm very excited to hear it.
Okay, my movie, regarded as an all-timer, first of all. When you're ready to jump in, just say what it is. A war movie. The lead performance was, at minimum, the third choice to play the role, to the point of which one of the first people, the second choice, or maybe the third choice to play the role, from what I have my research, let's call him the second because one of them is a little not sure. They actually filmed scenes with him, to the point of which you can watch those scenes online, which is wild, given it's kind of like, when you can see those scenes of Eric Stoltz starring in Back to the Future. It's just jarring to see this particular actor starring. The movie, the second and third billing people are both Oscar winners. The film itself, tell me when you want me to give it away. One of the deficits of the film, in my opinion, it was a madhouse of a production, lunacy. Director almost goes bankrupt. Stop me when you know what film we're talking about.
Oh, I've known.
Oh,
Yeah.
you've known. All right, then I'll just end with
War
this before
movie,
you say.
Vietnam War movie.
And before you say, I'll just say this. One
Yes.
of the big deficits of it to me is when the documentary about the making of the film is superior and a cut above the film itself, Then that's a problem with the film. What film am I talking about, Shiraz?
Talking about Apocalypse Now.
I am talking about Apocalypse Now, a film that, while it has amazing individual scenes, is so overwrought from the playing of This Is the End by The Doors, as Martin Sheen looks at the ceiling fan, to all the mythology of like Sheen really has a heart attack. Sheen, really punched a hole in the mirror, and I don't care. I don't care. It's like, is it a good movie? I sound like you when I say this. Like, I don't care about that part. I care, like, are you carrying me forward as a movie? And it's based on Heart of Darkness, of course, the Joseph Conrad book. Joseph Conrad's book is brilliant. Read it in high school. Shout out to Ms. Moustakas. It's also incredibly racist. It's an incredibly racist book. And that aspect of it is in this film. Like, who are the Vietnamese people in this film? I mean, they're beyond scenery. They're savage. And I want a film that does better than that. As I get older, I think Coppola certainly knew better. We can't be like, well, it was 1979. Nobody thought Vietnamese people were. That's just not true. And so that choice was deliberately made. There's also a terrific book by Viet Thanh Nguyen, which I absolutely adore. One of my favorite works of fiction in recent years. God, I'm blanking on the goddamn title of it. But I'm so much so that I'm going to look it up because I'm embarrassed. I'm not good with titles as I get older. We're not even going to edit this in post because I deserve it. It's called The Sympathizer. And The Sympathizer, right in the middle of the book, it's about a Vietnamese dude who's like a spy who moves to the United States at the behest of the Vietnamese Communist Party at the end of the world, at the end of the Vietnam War. And he actually gets a job as a technical advisor for a film based on Apocalypse Now. And it's such an incredible skewering of Coppola and the film that, frankly, it also colored my views of the film. The actor I was talking about before was, of course, Keitel. And I don't want to denigrate some of the great performances, although I think the great performances, it begins and ends with one, and that's Robert Duvall. Who's terrific as the sergeant who says, "I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory." The other actors, whether you're talking about Sheen or Brando's ridiculousness, which is just unwatchably absurd to me, his pontificating off script about things that make no sense, and you're supposed to think it's deep because it's Brando, or whether you're talking about who's the other one that, oh, Dennis Hopper, it's like, please stop talking. It's not a film for me. It's a film I've watched multiple times. It's a film I even watched in a film class. And if you want to show me Hearts of Darkness, the doc that is about the making of it, I'll watch that right now and be very happy. If you want to show me Apocalypse Now, I'm going to say, what else is on TV? I might not say the Blues Brothers, but I will look for something else to watch. There you go. That's my film.
Apocalypse Now is a movie again that I feel like I've known just about my whole life, and it's from exactly the same time period as Blues Brothers, our young lives, and I like Apocalypse. I don't love it. I don't swear
Okay.
by it. It's not in my soul. It's not in my bones, and I know it very, very well. Growing up, there were two movies about the Vietnam War that I saw when I was inappropriately young, and those were The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now. And just two movies that I've always known as being important. Important in film, important in cinema depiction of that war, which at the time was right in the rear view. And both of those films have become more problematic as I've gotten older and have revisited them. Apocalypse stands up better for me, actually, than
Definitely
Deer Hunter. Maybe we'll
agreed.
talk about Deer Hunter one day. But any criticisms that you or anybody would have about Apocalypse Now, in most cases, I probably wouldn't argue with that, although it is a movie that I like a lot. And I think part of it, you talked about the Mystique. It's almost the ultimate Mystique film. Jean had a heart attack. Coppola might have had a heart attack. There was, I mean,
He put his
everything was so.
all his money up for collateral, Coppola, to self-fund
It
it.
is such a le it was such a legendary production, resulting in this film, which did come off, that I think that adds so much to the esteem that it is held in. Yeah, Keitel would have been ridiculous for that role, as I think he would be for most roles.
I'm
And I
sorry.
believe that
That was
he,
funny.
Coppola knew it pretty early. I don't think too much was filmed with Harvey before they made the switch. Who was the first choice?
Oh, James Caan.
Ah, yeah, I don't think he would have been good. I like Martin Sheen a lot in this. I like Martin Sheen as an actor,
I do
and I
too.
think he's fine. I think he has that kind of traumatized, haunted, removed way about him that I think is appropriate for this. You're kind of he's the protagonist of this hallucinatory journey that you're taking, and it is not the most delightful journey, and it is not certainly not the most politically sensitive journey. Great, culminating in Hopper and Brando, and people would be very excused for finding that a huge letdown, that that's where this long journey has led. I find Brando watchably absurd.
Interesting. Okay.
As a I think him be of course it's him as Kurtz in a way, because right, it's very overwrought. It takes itself very seriously. And you had mentioned the high profile documentary on it, which is an excellent film. About 25 years or so after it was released, a redux version was released, kind of like a director's cut, that added, I think, I don't know, at least 20 minutes to what's already a 3-hour film. And I remember seeing that redux version, and I felt as though none of the scenes that Coppola had wanted to keep in that were taken out should have been kept in. I felt as though the released version was absolutely correct. The edits were the proper ones. There was no material I saw, which I was like, oh, that's gold. How could they leave that out? Oh, that would have tied so much together. I felt as though the right editorial decisions were made, the right cut was released, that story being told that way. And like you with the Blues Brothers, I don't really have counter arguments to say why it's great. Maybe I don't feel that it's great. And maybe in a way it took this talk to make me realize that I don't think it's as great as I've always kind of held it, because I actually do like it a lot. I'm not looking for a fast forward button. I don't need to watch it in a few different installments. I don't watch movies that way. I like warts and all, this is Coppola's crazy vision, and I like that vision. And I respect that vision as a film, if not as a ideological artifact or statement. But no, I mean, all of your comments about how the movie starts, If you really dig it, you really dig it. And then you're going to be on that wavelength and you're really, really going to be into what takes place and how it takes place. And if you don't, then I get that. And things are going to really kind of follow in that direction. You're absolutely right. Martin thrashing around and now he's bleeding and he's drunk and he's this. Right. No, I don't think that that's super profound. I don't think that that's film poetry. But I like the film a lot. I don't even think that I don't even think Duvall is like brilliant. I think he's just consistent with what it is because almost every character is very broad and is somewhat of a cartoon except for Sheen, who's like monotone, and that's kind of the point.
Yeah, I actually, you know what? I want to say, I don't like the opening scene because I think it's overwrought and silly. I do like Martin Sheen in this movie. So if you look at the opening scene as that's Martin Sheen, but you look at the rest of the film as this is his character Willard, I think he's pretty terrific. I'm just a big Sheen guy. I think his career should have been like 50% bigger than it was. His performance in Wall Street should have won an Oscar. Remember, what you see is a man who never judged another man's success by the size of his wallet. Beautiful stuff. Never forget it. So I'll put that caveat on it when I say the performances I like. But no, Apocalypse Now, it insists upon itself in a way that I find unpleasant.
And
So
I've
Shiraz.
heard, if not the dominant sentiment, I've heard in several different sources of Apocalypse Now being called, this is the ultimate Vietnam movie.
Yes, or it is Vietnam. I think
This
Coppola
is
said that.
Vietnam. And assuredly and thankfully, I can't speak of that first person, but there are certainly films about the Vietnam War which hit me on a more emotional level and which I find far more disturbing and resonant than this one. This one exists in its own world. It creates its own world. And I think that is to its credit. As I said, I get it if people don't like this journey or find it distasteful or instantly tiresome. I like this journey.
You
And
want to
if I
know?
see it every 15 years, then I'm enjoying revisiting it over that time period. It's always, I don't expect it to be a movie that I don't like. But again, there are movies by this director which are among the most important films to me on a personal level, and this is
Definitely.
not one of them.
That's a great point. And I'll also throw out that Apocalypse Now has a rewatchability factor, even though I don't like it. Like if I'm turning on the TV and there's a scene I want to see, and I can't say that about what is my favorite movie, American movie about the Vietnam War, because I think it captures the brutality of the United States in a way that's really effective, but it's not something I ever want to watch again, and that's Casualties of War with Sean Penn and Michael J. Fox. An incredibly hard watch, but an incredibly brilliant film. Brian De Palma bringing his skills to the table. Well, Shiraz, we're out of time right now. Unfortunately, I do have a hard out. This has been terrific. You doing good?
Oh, great. Yeah, it's been a ball.
This has been a lot of fun. Hey, I want to thank everybody for being part of making this show a reality. Thank you to The Nation Magazine. Thank you to my producer, David Tigaboo. And thank you extra to the hoops and movie savant, Arya Shirazi. Love talking to you, dude.
Likewise, man.
Hey,
Thank you.
for everybody out there, please stay frosty. I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace.